Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Sunday, the 26th of February, 2012, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. Episode 56 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each show we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT mega news roundup, we're going to have a look at an issue that's been creating controversy for about 150 years now. Charles Darwin, evolution and religion. Is the theory of evolution really such a threat to religion? Well, I'll tell you what I think about it for what that's worth. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at two recent films, both dealing with repressed same-sex attraction, J. Edgar and Schoenhaid. So for all that and more, stay tuned here to Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Now, of course, before I get into our LGBT news roundup, I should note that it's now been 7 months since the last episode of Reality Check, back on July 29th last year. That's because, well, basically, I have to work to make a living, and that consumes time that I would much rather be spending preparing episodes of Reality Check. So Reality Check episodes have become a bit sporadic these days, but hopefully that will change soon, and at least I'll be able to produce more episodes this year than I did last year. Well, I hope so. Okay, now on to business. Our LGBT news roundup for the last, well, for the last 7 months. And it is quite a mega news roundup, because obviously a lot has happened in that time. But I'm just going to focus on the highlights, and the positive highlights at that, because, well, there's always a lot of bad news, but I think the good news stories generally give a better picture of the way the world in general is heading when it comes to LGBT rights. So, first of all, let's have a look at what's happened in the steady and inevitable march towards global same-sex marriage. Now, in our last episode of Reality Check on July 29th, the state of New York in the US had just become the latest jurisdiction to get same-sex marriage. Too much celebration and fanfare. So what's happened since then? What other dominoes have fallen over the last 7 months in this now unstoppable movement? Well, as usual, most courts and governments around the world, it seems, have been waiting until Reality Check is ready to record a new episode before taking action. Because, really, coincidentally, everything's happened pretty much in the last few weeks. Now, let's start with the United States and the, well, frankly, extraordinary and unprecedented flurry of activity that's taken place there in four different states just over the last 2 weeks. So we're talking Washington, New Jersey, Maryland, and Maine. So, first of all, in a surprisingly rapid move, the state of Washington legalized full same-sex marriage. The bill was approved by the state legislature and then signed into law by the governor, Christine Gregoire, on February 13th, meaning that the law should come into effect on June 6th this year, making Washington state the 8th jurisdiction in the U.S. to achieve marriage equality. Now, I say it should come into effect in June because it's not a done deal yet. Because if the opponents of same-sex marriage gather 120,000 signatures in the meantime, then the law will be put on hold and will go to a referendum in November. And of course, dear listener, those nasty homophobes have already started collecting signatures to do just that. Let's hope they don't gather enough. But if they do get enough, let's hope that marriage equality wins at the ballot box in November. We'll just have to wait and see. Okay, so that's what's happened in Washington state. Let's cross the country now to the state of New Jersey, where the news is unfortunately not so rosy. Because in the very same week that the Washington governor signed her state's bill into law, the New Jersey governor, Republican Chris Christie, vetoed a same-sex marriage bill that had passed both houses of the state legislature. Yes, dear listener, can you believe it? On February 16th, for the first time ever, the New Jersey legislature voted to introduce same-sex marriage. And the very next day, the governor vetoed it. What a nasty, mean-spirited man. Well, apparently he wants to become President of the United States someday, and he doesn't want his reputation tarnished by being seen to support perverts and deviants, or something like that. So, disappointing news from New Jersey. But good news just hours ago from Maryland, because on Thursday, February 23rd, the state Senate approved a bill allowing same-sex marriage in the state of Maryland. The bill had already been approved by the lower house, and Governor Martin O'Malley has promised to sign it into law within days, meaning Maryland is looking set to become the 9th jurisdiction in the U.S. to get same-sex marriage. However, it looks highly likely that the same thing is going to happen in Maryland as what's happening in Washington state. The opponents of marriage equality are gathering signatures to get it put to a referendum in November. And I reckon they'll probably succeed in both states, and we'll be seeing marriage referenda taking place in those two states in November, I suspect. Oh, did I say two states? I really meant three states, because just days ago, on February 23rd, officials in the state of Maine announced that same-sex marriage supporters there had gathered enough signatures to put the issue to a referendum in November. So Maine is now definitely having a referendum. Washington and Maryland, well, most probably will as well. So it's looking like the 6th of November this year is going to be a major turning point for same-sex marriage in the United States, with three states likely to vote on the issue. Of course, on the same day as the presidential elections. So it's now still only February, but already 2012 is looking set to become the most momentous year in the fight for marriage equality in the US so far. We do live in interesting times. But don't worry, dear listener, whatever happens, we will, of course, keep you posted of all developments in future episodes of Reality Check. Now, sticking with the marriage theme, let's stay in the US just a little bit longer and do a quick update on the latest developments in the long-running legal soap opera known as Proposition 8. So, just to recap very briefly, in June 2008, the Supreme Court of California opened up civil marriage to same-sex couples. 5 months later, in November, that right was taken away when the voters of California approved Proposition 8, which amended the Californian Constitution to prohibit same-sex marriage. Since then, the question of the legal validity of Proposition 8 has been winding its way through the courts, first through the Californian state court system and then through the US federal court system. In August 2010, the most important decision so far came when Judge Vaughn Walker of the federal court found that Proposition 8 was unconstitutional, and so ruled that same-sex marriage should be reinstated in California. That decision was put on hold, however, after it was appealed to a three-judge panel in the Federal Court of Appeals. And just 3 weeks ago, on the 7th of February, the court handed down its decision, agreeing with Judge Walker and finding that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional. That is, it was a violation of the US federal constitution to take away the right to marriage that had been given to same-sex couples in California. Now, the interesting thing about this decision is that the judges were very clear in limiting their decision to California and did not rule on whether this means that all states throughout the country are obliged to open marriage to same-sex couples, even though they were deciding issues related to the federal constitution. So this is obviously wonderful news for California. But the real question is, what happens next? Because most observers had been thinking that this Proposition 8 case would make it all the way to the US Supreme Court, and a decision would be handed down there that applies to the whole country. But given the narrowness of the appeal court's decision, that may not happen now. It may just end here. California gets marriage back, and the case is closed. Well, at this point in time, nobody knows what's going to happen. Rumor has it that the proponents of Proposition 8 are planning to appeal the decision to the full 11-judge bench of the Federal Appeals Court. But will the court even agree to hear it? Will it ever get to the US Supreme Court, or will same-sex couples resume marrying in California within days? Well, nobody knows. But whatever happens, dear listener, you'll certainly be hearing about it here on Reality Check. Okay, so that's the United States out of the way as far as marriage is concerned, but what about the rest of the world? What other parts of the world have come close or even achieved full marriage equality over the last 7 months? Well, actually, surprisingly, only one. Despite movements towards same-sex marriage in many places, including right here in Australia, only one jurisdiction in the world has actually achieved marriage equality in these last 7 months. And that's a place you've probably actually never heard of. It's the tiny northeastern state of Alagoas in Brazil. Not what you were expecting? Well, dear listener, the world is always full of interesting surprises. And Alagoas is now the latest jurisdiction in the world to open marriage to same-sex couples. But hang on, let's backtrack for a moment just to get everything in perspective. And let's look at the whole complicated situation of what's going on with same-sex marriage in Brazil. Brazil is an enormous, unwieldy, complex country, and it seems the marriage situation is no less complicated and unwieldy. Now, we discussed this quite a bit in our last two episodes of Reality Check last July, so let's see what's happened since then that's led to this great news from Alagoas. So basically, to recap, first of all, on May 5th last year, the Brazilian Supreme Court effectively introduced civil unions for same-sex couples throughout the entire country. It ruled that any same-sex couple in Brazil can go to a registry office and get what they call a certificate of stable union or civil union that gives all the same rights and responsibilities of civil marriage. Then, in June last year, individual couples throughout Brazil began going to courts around the country to ask judges to convert their civil union into a civil marriage. And judges have been giving them what they want. So now, 8 months later, Dozens of same-sex couples throughout Brazil have gone through this process and are legally married. But of course, the question is this all actually legal? Were the judges right to do this? Can the legal validity of these marriages be appealed and overturned? Some judges across the country refused to convert civil unions into marriages. Others did it happily. It was all very messy and confusing. So this question was put to the test on October 25th, when the Superior Court of Justice, that is effectively the second highest court in the country, ruled that, yes, judges are acting legally when they convert civil unions into marriages, and yes, all those marriages are legally valid. So just like that, all those marriages that have been performed and were in doubt are now legally secure. So very exciting news. So does that mean we can now say that Brazil ranks among the list of countries that now allow same-sex marriage? Well, I think yes, in this kind of convoluted way that involves first getting a civil union and then going to court to convert it into a marriage. So that's the situation that now prevails in all of the country, except in the state of Alagoas, because there, on the 6th of January this year, came the most exciting development of all. A judge in Alagoas ruled that same-sex couples in the state shouldn't have to go through this convoluted process. They should just be able to go to the registry office and get married, just like opposite-sex couples can do. And so, on January 17th, two men in Alagoas did just that, becoming the first couple in Brazil to legally marry without going to court. They are Alejandro César Freire Ogambigi and Enilson Alves da Costa, together for 25 years and now finally married. A truly historic moment. And just like that, the state of Alagoas in Brazil has become the latest jurisdiction in the world to achieve full marriage equality. So a big congratulations to Alejandro and Enilson, and to all our beloved Reality Check listeners in Alagoas. Parabéns pra vocês! And so technically, over these past 7 months, Alagoas is actually the only jurisdiction in the world to have achieved marriage equality, following New York in July last year. Of course, there has been quite a lot of movement towards marriage equality in other places, even if it hasn't quite yet been achieved. For example, here in Australia, we saw history made when the ruling Australian Labor Party at its national conference in December last year voted to adopt a policy platform in favour of marriage equality. However, in a compromise deal, the party also agreed to allow federal MPs a conscience vote on the issue. Now, since then, three marriage equality bills have been introduced into the federal parliament. And presumably at least one of them, well, it only requires one, not sure why there are three, but anyway, one of them will be voted on later this year. It's looking like the coalition now will probably allow its backbenchers at least to have a conscience vote on the issue as well, so there's a glimmer of hope that it just might get through. In the meantime, there's also another Senate inquiry into the issue. We saw one in 2009, now they've got another one. So that means that probably nothing will be voted on until that inquiry is over, later in the year. Either way, it looks like 2012 is shaping up to be a decisive year for marriage equality in Australia, as well as in the US. Maybe the vote in the Australian Parliament will even take place around the same time as the votes in Maine, Maryland, and Washington. Could be an interesting conjunction of events there. But whatever happens, dear listener, you know that we will always keep you up to date right here on Reality Check. Finally, quickly, the other bit of marriage equality news I wanted to mention is, well, what I think is the amazing news from the UK. Because in October last year, David Cameron, the British Prime Minister and leader of the Conservative Party, came out unequivocally in favour of same-sex marriage. Yes, dear listener, you heard right. A Conservative Prime Minister of the UK supports full marriage equality. Now that, to me, is astounding, and a clear sign that when it comes to LGBT rights, we are living in the middle of a major historic shift taking place throughout the world. So now that the leaders of all three major political parties in the UK, Labour, the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives, all support marriage equality, well, it's clearly only a matter of time before equality is achieved. And it's now looking highly likely that the UK will be one of the next countries to get same-sex marriage, and most extraordinarily, it's looking like it will happen under a Conservative government. I wouldn't have seen that coming, but it just goes to show, dear listener, life is full of surprises. Now, as for non-marriage news, well, I mean, obviously a lot has happened there as well, but let me just touch on a few events of interest. One piece of good news from the last 7 months is that the world saw its first openly gay male prime minister of modern times. Of course, Iceland had the first openly LGBT head of government when Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir became prime minister there in February 2009. She is, of course, a lesbian, but the first openly gay man to become a head of government was Elio Di Rupo, who became the prime minister of Belgium on the 6th of December last year. So Iceland and Belgium leading the way in LGBT equality. Both have same-sex marriage, and now both also have lesbian or gay prime ministers. A sign of the times. Now let's return briefly to the United States for another piece of good news, and that is that, well, unlike the Proposition 8 saga, which is still ongoing, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell saga finally has come to a definitive end. On the 20th of September last year, the policy that prevented openly gay, lesbian and bisexual people from serving in the US Armed Forces was finally abolished, effectively by an executive order from President Obama. So that horrible policy is now relegated to the pages of history at long last. And I have to say, dear listener, it's only been 5 months since it was gotten rid of, but it already feels like something of a bygone age. So yet another sign that we do make progress slowly, and these battles, even if they go on for 18 years, as this one did, can eventually be won in the end. Now, from Washington, D.C., let's head across the Atlantic to the UN office in Geneva for another piece of good news from these last few months. On the 16th of December 2011, for the first time ever, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights released a report on discrimination and violence based on sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, I don't know if you remember, dear listener, but back in episode 54 of Reality Check, we talked about the historic resolution passed at the UN Human Rights Council in June last year, expressing grave concern at acts of violence and discrimination against LGBT people, and calling for a study to be prepared looking into the issue. Well, that's the study that was released in December. And I'm sure it comes as no surprise to learn that the report found widespread discrimination and violence faced by LGBT people worldwide. And most encouragingly, it called on all states to end these human rights violations in accordance with international human rights law. What happens now is that the report will be presented to the Human Rights Council in March. So, well, in just a few days' time, actually, and a panel discussion will take place on what should be done. Now, that will be an interesting discussion, I'm sure, and probably quite heated. But whatever happens, dear listener, the most exciting thing about all this is that finally, after decades of neglect, the rights of LGBT people are actually being discussed at the UN and recognized as basic human rights. This is an historic first step, and one that I hope we will continue to build on. Now, almost at the end, our final news item now for the last 7 months comes from a bit closer to home, and that is the news that on the 30th of November last year, the Parliament of Queensland approved a bill to introduce civil unions. And that law came into effect last week, actually, on February 23rd. So that means that Queensland now joins Tasmania, Victoria, New South Wales and the ACT in allowing same-sex couples to enter into a civil union, if they so choose. Meaning that, interestingly, the entire east coast of Australia now has civil unions. So South Australia, Western Australia and the Northern Territory are shamefully lagging behind and need to get with the program and introduce civil unions schemes as well. Well, unless, of course, the entire country gets same-sex marriage before that happens, but even so, that shouldn't stop them. Anyway, whatever happens, dear listener, we promise to keep you well informed here on Reality Check. All right, that was probably our biggest LGBT news roundup ever here on Reality Check. But we did have a lot to get through. Let's take a quick break now and listen to a song. And when we come back, we'll have a look at the perennially controversial issue of Charles Darwin, the theory of evolution, and what it all means for religion. So don't go away. Much more Reality Check coming up here on Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9.
Hola, soy Unax Ugalde y estás escuchando la primera y única estación de radio gay y lésbica de Australia, Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Peligro by Mexican pop group Rake. Okay, we now move into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. But today we're going to do something slightly different, but closely related, because we're getting into the field of where science bumps up against religion. We're talking about the theory of evolution and what it means for religion. And I was inspired to talk about this issue because February is Darwin Month, February 12th being Darwin Day, which this year marked the 203rd anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. Yes, dear listener, Darwin was born back in 1809, and 50 years later, in 1859, he published On the Origin of Species. In my opinion, the most important book ever written. Now, I'll get on to Darwin and religion in a moment, but first I just want to make perfectly clear how unarguably true and solid the theory of evolution is. Because it's come under so much attack over the last 150 years that some people are left with the impression, well, particularly people with just a passing interest in science, that the evidence for evolution is not yet completely conclusive, that there's still a scientific debate as to whether evolution has been proven yet, that it's still, quote-unquote, just a theory. George W. Bush once stated that the jury's still out when it comes to evolution. Now, I need to make this clear. This impression is completely false. The evidence for the development of all species of life through evolution by natural selection is conclusive and overwhelming. There is no scientific debate at all about whether evolution occurs or not. There is some scientific debate about how it functions in some specific cases and some of its mechanisms, but none whatsoever about whether evolution is true, or whether it explains the diversity of life. Those questions were resolved long ago. To quote Richard Dawkins, "The theory of evolution is actually a fact, as incontrovertible a fact as any in science." And just in case you're still not convinced, dear listener, about the complete unimpeachability of the theory of evolution, let me tell you what, for me, is the most convincing evidence of all. Now, people commonly think that the best evidence for evolution is the evidence from paleontology, that is, the fossil record. And, of course, the fossil record is superb evidence of evolution. I mean, every fossil ever discovered confirms the theory of evolution. There's actually an interesting anecdote about the British evolutionary biologist J.B.S. Haldane, who was engaged in a debate with a creationist and was asked what evidence would be sufficient to falsify the theory of evolution. And Haldane replied that the fossil of a rabbit in the Precambrian would do it. Now, the Precambrian, dear listener, just in case you, like me, didn't know exactly when that was the period of time when life was first evolving, before there were any hard-shelled organisms at all. So there were pretty much no fossils from that time. So to find a fossil of a mammal, such as a rabbit, in the Precambrian would certainly raise a lot of questions. But of course, this has never happened, and instead, every fossil ever found has been right where it would be expected to be, according to the theory of evolution. So that's millions and millions of pieces of evidence just from the fossil record. Now, of course, there is other evidence for evolution. There's the evidence from comparative anatomy, that is, tracing certain anatomical forms throughout the evolution of plants and animals. For example, almost all land vertebrates have 5 digits on the end of each limb, because we all evolved from a common ancestor. Then there's also the evidence from geographical distribution. This involves looking at the distribution of species and variations of species across continents and islands. For example, the slight differences in the species of finches from island to island across the Galapagos archipelago that Darwin famously studied. And these are broadly the 3 main sources of evidence that Darwin relied on when he was writing back in the mid-19th century: fossils, comparative anatomy, and the geographical distribution. But of course, since then, a whole new field of biological science has opened up, which conclusively proves that Darwin was right. And I'm talking about genetics. Because nowadays, not only does every fossil discovered continue to confirm the theory of evolution, but every DNA test also confirms the theory of evolution. With modern DNA sequencing, we can now trace the evolution of species mutation by mutation. That, for me, is the clincher and is the best evidence there is that the theory of evolution is certainly true. And the study of genetics coming decades after Darwin's book, for me, it's kind of like analogous to being a detective on a murder case and finding, for example, the suspect's fingerprints at the scene of the crime, finding the gun in the suspect's house, and finding bloodstains all over the suspect's clothes. Now, that's all pretty convincing evidence and enough to get a conviction. And then, years later, imagine that you find the CCTV video footage of the suspect actually committing the murder. Well, now your case is completely conclusive. The new evidence you found backs up everything you'd suspected all along and removes any possible doubts. So for me, that's what the study of genetics does for the theory of evolution. It confirms, without the shadow of a doubt, everything that Darwin came up with to explain the diversity of life on Earth. And, well, interestingly, when the study of genetics came along, it caused a bit of a shake-up in some of the traditional groupings of species that had, well, species until that point had been grouped based on morphology, that is, based on the form and structure and general look of the animal. So some species that looked very similar were in the same group, but with genetic analysis were discovered to be actually quite distantly related, whereas other species that looked very different were actually found to be close cousins when you looked at their DNA. For example, the Tasmanian tiger and the grey wolf look pretty similar, but genetics shows that they are only distantly related. Or another example, the echidna looks a lot like a porcupine or a hedgehog, but is actually much more closely related to the platypus. Or another example, the closest living relatives of the hippopotamus are in fact the cetaceans, that is, the whales and the dolphins, which came as quite a surprise to many people. And of course, with DNA testing and analysis, we've been able to determine that we humans share 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees, and about 50% of our DNA with a banana. Yes, dear listener, think about that next time you slice one up on your breakfast cereal. That's your cousin you're cutting up into little pieces there. So let's be perfectly clear here. Let nobody get away with saying that the jury's still out on evolution. Nowadays, with genetics and DNA analysis, evolution is, as Dawkins said, an incontrovertible fact. Okay, now that we've established that, let's get onto the perennially thorny issue of Darwin and religion. And I particularly want to talk about what a big shake-up to religion the theory of evolution was. Because I think a lot of people still don't really appreciate that. Because nowadays, most religions, well, at least most sects of Christianity, accept the theory of evolution. Even the Vatican accepts, quote, that there is no conflict between evolution and the doctrine of the faith, end quote. Of course, they then add that evolution was guided by the hand of God, but still, they accept the theory. So it seems, at first glance, that evolution and religious faith can, and in fact do, coexist without too much problem. They're compatible, religion can accommodate evolution in its teachings, so no big deal. But I actually think that for the long-term survival of religion, the theory of evolution is a very big deal, and one that ultimately, in the long run, I suspect will doom most religions to extinction. Now, let me explain what I mean. Very broadly, humanity has gone through two revolutions in scientific thought that fundamentally shook up our view of ourselves and our place in the universe, and posed huge challenges to the religions of the day. Now, the first was the Copernican Revolution in the 16th century, through which we discovered that the Earth is not actually the center of the universe. So, not actually at the center of God's creation, or possibly even at the center of God's concern. We discovered that the Earth is just a planet like the others, and goes around the Sun just like the other planets. Then, over the next few hundred years, we discovered that the stars are other suns, and that there are hundreds of billions of them in the galaxy. And then, just in the last century, we discovered that not only do we live in a galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars, but our galaxy itself is just one of hundreds of billions of galaxies. And now, with the developing theories of the multiverse, it may turn out that our universe is just one of an incredibly large number of universes. Who knows? Anyway, the important point is that we went from believing we were the center of the universe and the center of creation to discovering that we are just tiny creatures on a planet orbiting one of trillions and trillions of stars in the universe. Now that's a pretty big shock to the system. The second revolution was, of course, the development of the theory of evolution in the mid-19th century. And let's just reflect for a moment on what a shock to the system that was. Because I reckon that if I had lived before Darwin, I would have believed in a deity of some kind. Because, I mean, look around you. We exist. Humans exist. How could you explain how we came into existence if not by a god or some kind of deity? I mean, look at us. We are conscious. We're intelligent. We have free will. We are, in fact, like little gods ourselves. So we must have been created by a higher being, right? So there must be a god. There can be no other explanation. I mean, you think we just crawled up out of the mud with nobody to create us? I mean, that's ridiculous. That's impossible. And then, of course, Darwin comes along and says, actually, as surprising as this may seem, yes, we did all just crawl up out of the mud, in a manner of speaking, and let me explain how. This is called evolution through natural selection. And then when he laid down all the evidence on the table, and it became clear that, well, yes, this explains the appearance of all forms of life, even us, even humans, without any recourse to God or any supernatural being, well, wow, what a body blow. Suddenly, you don't need the existence of God to explain anything. It's all explained through a few basic laws of physics. Set the whole thing in motion and voila, you've got evolution and you've got humans. No need for God anymore. So that must have been a huge, huge blow to religion. And I reckon it's the biggest blow that religions have ever suffered. So sure, religion can cling on for a few more centuries saying, well, yes, okay, evolution is true, but God's there guiding it along. But gradually, I suspect fewer and fewer people are going to buy that story. Because this whole evolution is true, but God's controlling it is kind of like saying to a kid, well, okay, it may be true that it's your mum and dad who actually physically put the toys into your stocking, but it's really Santa Claus who's guiding them, controlling them from the North Pole via satellite phone. Yeah. Pretty soon, the kid's going to realize that you just don't need the whole Santa Claus hypothesis to explain what's really going on. It's just mum and dad. And they're not being controlled by an invisible Santa Claus. Likewise, after Darwin, we don't need God anymore to explain the existence and diversity of life on Earth, or to explain our own existence. And that's something that I suspect religions will never be able to overcome. For example, that's pretty much the reason that I'm an atheist. I just see no compelling evidence for the existence of a god or gods or deities, or in fact any kind of supernatural being. Everything can pretty much be explained without recourse to some god or power from beyond the natural world. And that brings me to the final point I want to make today. And that is the thing that disappoints me most about religion. And that is not that it denies evolution, although many religions do, but that it denies just how amazing we humans are. Because look at evolution. Look at that story. Look at how we came into existence through natural selection over billions of years. Now that's an amazing and awe-inspiring story. We came about just from these relatively simple natural processes, and they produced us, beings that are conscious and intelligent and who can examine the universe and examine ourselves and even discover how we came to be, how we came to exist. And once we've discovered that, well, for all we know, we are the most complex and intelligent things in the entire universe. Right? Us. Until today, we have no evidence of anything smarter than us in the entire universe. We're it. We are, as Carl Sagan once said, we are a way for the cosmos to know itself. Now that's profound and amazing and awesome. And yet religions cause people to not appreciate this. They cause people to imagine that there are more powerful beings that are watching them and judging them. And this makes people feel lowly and inadequate and inferior to those imaginary supernatural beings. And worst of all, some religions, like Catholicism, not only tell people that they need to worship and adore and give thanks to these imaginary beings, but also they convince people that they are unworthy, they are flawed, that they are born carrying original sin, that they are sinners from birth to death and somehow dirty and tainted, and they make them feel guilty all their lives, especially when it comes to sexuality, which is something completely natural and innate and healthy. Can you imagine anything more harmful and destructive to human happiness? And quite simply, more contrary to reality as we know it to be? So, that's it, dear listener. That's what I find the most frustrating and disappointing thing about religion. That instead of going around telling individuals, hey, did you know that as far as we know, you are the most amazing and intelligent thing that exists in the universe? You are the way for the cosmos to know itself. No, they go around telling people that they are flawed and unworthy and they have to cower and bow down to some imaginary creature in the sky. It's so sad to me that most of humanity falls for this wicked and, I believe, evil deception. Anyway, those are my opinions on the topic for what they're worth. If you'd like to send in your opinion or a comment or question on today's topic or an idea for a future topic, please send us an email. The address is realitycheck.tony@gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too for past episodes of Reality Check. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie reviews.
Check out our podcast on the Joy website, joy.org.au.
How could one species turn into another? How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, they're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical.
Only the fittest survive. And that was the key. Was the key. Natural selection. That was the key.
We are surrounded by endless forms. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. There is grandeur in this view of life. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth.
The history of life can be thought of as a many-branched tree. The five kingdoms of life were established early on. Bacteria, protists, amoeba-like creatures, fungi, plants, and animals.
We find ourselves perched on one tiny twig, in the midst of a blossoming tree of life. Perched on one tiny twig, in the midst of a blossoming tree of life.
Only the fittest survive, and that was the key. Natural selection. That was the key.
We are surrounded by endless forms. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. There is grandeur in this view of life. Most beautiful, most wonderful. Evolution, the greatest show on earth. We are surrounded by millions of other species. Walking, flying, burrowing, stalking, chasing, fleeing, outpacing.
Animals strive to reach this one ultimate goal, to ensure the survival of the next generation. This one ultimate goal, to pass on their genes. That is what life is all about, is all about.
There is grandeur in this view of life.
Most beautiful, most wonderful.
Evolution, the greatest show on earth. As we look back on the history of life, we see a picture of never-ending, ever-rejuvenating novelty.
Those animals may seem to us to be very remote, strange, even fantastic. But all of us alive today owe our very existence to them.
Hey there, I'm Adam Lambert, and you're listening to Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au, and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was an evolution-themed song, in case you didn't get that, called The Greatest Show on Earth, the latest creation from John Boswell over at the website symphonyofscience.com. He now has 13 science-related songs on his website, all well worth checking out. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the two movies up for review today are J. Edgar and Schoenhaid. Let's begin with J. Edgar. This is the latest offering from the now 81-year-old Clint Eastwood. And I decided to talk about J. Edgar today because of all the movies I've seen over the last couple of months, it's the one that I've enjoyed the most. J. Edgar is the second screenplay written by Dustin Lance Black, his first being Milk, another film that I enjoyed very much. So he's shaping up to be a pretty talented screenwriter, I reckon. Dustin Lance Black is gay, and his two screenplays, Milk and J. Edgar, deal with the lives of two of the most influential gay men in the history of the United States in the 20th century. Well, maybe I wouldn't use the word gay to describe J. Edgar Hoover because, well, I think that implies some sort of identification with the word and some sort of self-acceptance. So maybe the better terminology is just same-sex attracted. Anyway, onto the movie itself. J. Edgar tells the story of the life and career of J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI for almost 50 years. Yes, dear listener, 50 years, from 1924 until his death in 1972. And apart from the fact that I think the film is captivating and gripping throughout, I also found it interesting because I knew very little about J. Edgar Hoover and the immense power that he wielded. He served under 8 US presidents. And, well, at least according to the film, one of the reasons he was able to stay in power so long was thanks to the stash of personal and confidential files he kept on every political figure in the country. Files that he could use to manipulate and blackmail them. The film shows him trying to blackmail both John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King with secret recordings that he'd made of them in compromising situations. The film focuses particularly on the FBI investigation surrounding the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby in 1932, one of the biggest crime stories of the 20th century. Again, something I didn't know that much about, so found quite fascinating. Another historical period that the film touches on, and that I also found very interesting, is the period known as the First Red Scare in 1919 and 1920, when the United States became terrified of the threat posed by Bolshevism and anarchism, following a series of strikes, riots and bombings by anarchists, including the bombing of Wall Street in 1920. According to the film, Hoover was a keen young employee at the Justice Department during that period, and living through those events played a formative role in the hatred of communism and of dissidents that he would maintain throughout his life. But the most compelling element of the film is Hoover's repressed homosexuality and his deep and abiding love affair with his deputy, Clyde Tolson. But a strange love affair it is indeed. And I won't give away whether it's actually consummated in the movie or not, but I will say that the scene where the two go back to their adjoining hotel rooms after a day at the races is one of the most dramatic and memorable that I've seen for some time. Of course, Hoover was never out, and he hunted down and threatened anyone who made insinuations about his sexuality, while at the same time using evidence of same-sex relationships to blackmail his perceived enemies. Notably, the film shows him gathering evidence on Eleanor Roosevelt and one of her female lovers. And of course, nobody really knows what Hoover's sexual orientation was. It's all just speculation. And I've heard some criticisms of the film saying it doesn't go far enough in depicting Hoover's same-sex liaisons. But regardless of where the truth lies, and we'll probably never know, I did enjoy the film very much as a story about a same-sex attracted man with immense power and living in an extremely homophobic environment, and the effects that such a situation has on him, creating a very conflicted and complicated personality. Now, finally, just before I finish talking about J. Edgar, I do want to mention that I think Leonardo DiCaprio's portrayal of him is really good, and I'm disappointed that he didn't get an Oscar nomination for the role. In fact, the movie got no Oscar nominations at all, and received generally mixed reviews. Something I don't understand. In my opinion, it's definitely a film worth seeing. And although we're only 2 months into the year, it's my favourite film of the year so far. Now, for our second movie review this evening, let's change pace a little bit and head to South Africa, and to another film that depicts a man dealing with his repressed same-sex attraction in a very homophobic environment. And I'm talking about the film Skoonhaid, or in English it's translated as Beauty. Now, whereas J. Edgar is my favourite movie of 2012 so far, Skoonhaid was my film of the year for 2011. And I'm guessing, most likely, dear listener, that you've probably never heard of it. Which brings me to a theme we've harped on about many times here at Reality Check, which is, why is it that the best movies, or even just good movies, get so poorly distributed, or not distributed at all? It's one of my eternal laments. Now, I saw Skoonhaid at the Melbourne International Film Festival last August, so it may just be that this movie is still doing the festival circuit and will come out on general release throughout the world later this year. I certainly hope so, because this is a movie that definitely deserves to be seen. Skoonhaid is a South African film that won the Queer Palm Award at the Cannes Film Festival last year, and made history by becoming the first film in Afrikaans to screen at the festival. And, well, I think that's part of what bowled me over last year when I saw it. Here's a film I'd never heard of, from a director, Oliver Hermanus, I'd also never heard of, coming out of South Africa, spoken entirely in Afrikaans, so completely coming out of left field, and yet it was such a powerful and accomplished first film, I was quite blown away. Anyway, dear listener, I won't go on too much about this film because it might still be some time before you get the chance to see it. But basically, the film tells the story of Francois, a white, middle-aged man living in an Afrikaner community in a small town in rural South Africa. He's married with children and has all the macho, racist and homophobic attitudes typical in men of his generation and society. The difference in his case, however, is that he's same-sex attracted. And when an old friend of his comes to visit with his now grown up and incredibly handsome son, well, Francois becomes obsessed. And I won't give too much away, but let's just say that his obsession leads to very dramatic consequences. So, dear listener, that's all I'll say on this movie for the time being. But keep it in mind, Skoonhaid, or Beauty, as it's called in English. And if it comes to a film festival near you, I would thoroughly recommend checking it out. It's not a perfect film, but it is definitely an example of fresh, original, moving, and surprisingly accomplished independent filmmaking. Well, that brings us to the end of the 56th episode of Reality Check. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website to subscribe to the podcast. That's at realitycheckonline.net. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll be back with the next episode sometime in the coming weeks.
Thanks for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.